paramedic here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Shermichael Singleton, a conservative CNN contributor and former staffer for Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, Ben Carson, and the Trump administration, joins the show. We talk about being a conservative on CNN.
What is it like working with Scott Jennings and being across the table from him?
Donald Trump.
Some Republicans have allowed their dislike of Trump to soften or suspend their conservative critique of liberalism.
Black Americans and DEI.
But what we're not going to do is say that we're going to guarantee that everybody should have the same success, because you can't, Josh.
And the big, beautiful bill.
I would probably say, Mr. President, this isn't the bill. I would say, Mr. President, we have to cut. I would explain to the president, if we don't try to do this now, I would explain to him what is to come over the next 10 years and then the next 25 years.
The full unedited conversation starts right now. Shermichael Singleton, everybody's joining the show right now. Shermichael, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, man, it's a pleasure to be on with you. And it's so crazy how we met, you reacting to one of my videos, which I get a lot of Google alerts of people reacting to my clips from CNN. And I usually always make a habit of going to every single person's page, whether it's a large channel or even sometimes people with a couple hundred followers. And I always reply, and people, and it's so funny to me, Josh, they're always shocked that I go and reply. And then people say, well, is this really you? And I say, well, yeah, it's really me. I thought this was a good analysis. Thanks for doing this.
So I appreciate
that. It's a
pleasure
to be here, man.
Thank you. Well, we're actually going to be getting to that video a little bit later, because people loved it. I mean, tons of people in the comments talking about what you're talking about. A lot of Black Americans, I think, kind of resonate with that. Like I said, we'll get to that in a second. First, I wanted to show you a video. This is a video of you and Van Jones talking about the first 100 days of Trump's presidency. Mm-hmm. I like Van Jones a lot. I'm sure you do as well, even though he's liberal. I think he's a funny guy. I want to show you this clip, and then I'm going to ask you a little bit about the not the first 100 days of Trump, but since then. So without further ado, let's play this clip.
Donald Trump absolutely gets an A because he did what no other Republican did before him. He got groups to vote for him who said they would never vote Republican. Well, they did, and they voted for Trump. What you got to say about that, Van?
F. Of
course,
I give this man an F. You're so proud of Donald Trump getting votes last year. The people who voted for him are losing hope, losing confidence, consumer confidence in the garbage can, in the toilet, and starting to swirl. Donald Trump is an F minus at best. And you know it. You got to go all the way back. You got to go all the way back to the election.
You know what's interesting? You know what's interesting about this, though, Van?
What?
They still trust him more to lead the country than Democrats.
Not on the economy.
There is not a city or town in this country that was once thriving because of manufacturing that's now decimated with hopelessness, drugs, crime.
All that.
People were hoping that their children would have a better future than them.
I agree.
And if there is a president that's saying we have to do something to tackle it, now even as a Republican, I would say that the president could do a better job. I think we could be more tactical in our approach here. I think how we deal with China and the disposition there needs to be framed a little better and communicated better. I agree with all of that. But you cannot deny that we have seen a significant portion of people in this country recede in terms of their economic probability and sustainability. We got to fix that, Van.
Okay, but here.
So, in my opinion, the first 100 days of Trump's presidency look very different than the last few days we've seen since then. So my question for you, what I'm curious to get your take on, is now looking back at all of his second term so far that we have, would you still give him an A?
Yeah, I would still give him an A. I think there's always room for improvement. So I guess one could say, well, is it an A plus or an A minus, you know, whatever. I think there's always room for improvement. One area that I think the president could improve a lot on, and this isn't really on him so much as it is on members of Congress. I don't think Republicans in Congress have done enough to exert their legislative authority as guaranteed, protected, authorized by the Constitution. And I say that in part, Josh, because we just saw the U.S. Trade Courts, I believe yesterday, pretty much said, like, hey, President Trump, you can't do this blanket tariffs. And they didn't make a decision on whether or not they agreed with the decisions of the executive or not. They merely said, just based on the Constitution, the way it's written, this power does rest with Congress in terms of blanket tariffs. They didn't say that the president couldn't have maybe a strategic tariff here or there. They said this blanket global tariff, that tariffs, you don't have the authority to do that. I'm not surprised by the ruling. And I think I even acknowledged on air a couple of weeks ago, like, I could see if this were challenged in court. I could see how a court might say, we're not going to get into whether you should do this or not. But in terms of authority, this really does kind of rest with Congress. And look, I'm a conservative. I'm a constitutionalist. It is what it is. My thing is, if I'm advising President Trump, I would say, look, Mr. President, we can contest this. Let's appeal it. But we also need to use the bully pulpit and go to Congress and say, look, we got the House and the Senate because of me. You guys need to do your job and support me in trying to have an equilibrium with our allies and also better trade relations with our adversaries, countries such as China. But it doesn't make any sense for me as the executive attempting to do everything when the Constitution isn't written in a way for me to do everything. The Constitution is written in a way for Congress to work in tandem with the executive on certain issues and obviously push back when necessary, but to certainly work in tandem with the executive to get things done. Josh, Republicans in Congress aren't doing anything. I mean, it just baffles me that the American people, the Republican Party, votes for these guys to go do a job and they're sitting on their hands. And so as a result, the executive has had to almost unilaterally do things that the executive shouldn't have to unilaterally do because the authority on some of these cases does indeed rest with Congress. So I would argue, and I know some conservatives have been upset about this, I view it differently. I would say, guys, pause. What they literally just did, this court just gave the president the opportunity to use the bully pulpit to go to Congress and say, all right, this is how a court ruled. They've essentially put the ball in your court. You know where I stand on this, Republicans. You know that most of the Republican Party stands with me on wanting to have an equilibrium with trade, better trade with our allies, less of a deficit that currently exists. Do your job, craft the legislation, get it passed, or pass something to authorize me in this particular case to have blanket or carte blanche authority to get this stuff done. One of the two, but you have to do something. They're doing absolutely nothing. And so I see this, Josh, as an opportunity for President Trump, strategically speaking, to not have to go it alone, because I got to tell you something. I wouldn't want a Democrat to try to usurp Congress's authority. Let's say we have a Republican majority in the House and a Democrat in the executive, and the Democrats say, well, to hell with what Republicans want in Congress, although the people voted for these Republicans. I'm going to go do whatever I want on trade, a trade that I may not agree with. Like, maybe they have more of a globalist perspective on trade, which I think most Democrats really do, and even a lot of Republicans really do. And I think one of the reasons you really haven't seen, Josh, Republicans come to support the president is because they don't agree with him. They don't agree with resetting trade standards in the country, because many Republicans, like many Democrats in the early 90s with NAFTA, agreed that if we outsource a lot of jobs, yeah, we're going to lose a little bit, but we're going to get better jobs. We're going to get cheaper goods. Well, yeah, we got the cheaper goods, but we didn't get better jobs. 90,000+ manufacturing plants closed, hundreds of thousands of American jobs dissipated. Cities, towns, counties across this country have now seen the wrath of that trade. And what has the result been? Drugs and crime and the stench of hopelessness that spread like a cancer with no treatment to stop it. Now, President Trump attempted in the first term to correct this. Could have did a little bit better, in my opinion. I don't think it went far enough. So he's come back. And now he's trying to go a little further. Republicans need to do their jobs.
Yeah, so I don't blame him. I think we're on the same page where, like, I don't blame President Trump for kind of extending the authority of the executive branch as far as it can take him. And then if the judges shoot it down, you have to go, all right, well, perfect opportunity to go to Congress, like you were saying. Yep. What I'm curious about is, and you touched on this at the end, is at the end of the day, do most Republicans not want to do this in Congress because their constituents don't want the tariffs at the end of the day? Do you really think that a majority of Americans want the tariffs, or do you think they are more globalist, like you were saying?
I think Republicans and the Republican Party, traditionally speaking, has been a party of very affluent individuals. The disconnectedness and the dislocation that we've seen in terms of the voting electorate in this country, where the working class is shifting to the Republican Party, is a new phenomenon. Remember, going all the way back to the New Deal, the Democrats were always a party of the working class, those who did not have a college degree, while Republicans were the country club boys, the good old boys, the highly educated, the high net worth individuals. Well, we still do have high net worth individuals and highly educated people in our party, but we're also getting a lot of working class people who don't have college degrees, which, by the way, represents 62% of the American population who don't have a college degree at all. And so I think a lot of Republicans in Congress still view trade through the vein of the old Republican Party, which is that they're big free trade guys. It's a Milton Friedman philosophy and worldview on trade. And look, I respect the hell out of Milton Friedman. He was brilliant. But I also think he was wrong on free trade. I think he was wrong on free trade because what you do as a net result, you decimate a significant percent of your working class. The United States of America has a $16+ trillion consumer economy, not because of the rich people we have, but because of the middle and working class that we have. So why would you decimate that? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And so now the question becomes, are we going to go back to the halcyon days where great manufacturing was booming and bustling? No, that I don't think we're going to go back to that. But can we go back to having strategic reshoring of certain industries? Steel and aluminum, absolutely. Maybe we can do something with rare earth minerals. Right now, we're importing, Josh, 70% of rare earth minerals are imported from China, our adversary. If we ever got into a foreign conflict with the Chinese, which some analysts say is possible in the next decade or so, they will put an embargo on everything going to the United States. And we use rare earth minerals, if people aren't aware, to build missiles, for our navigation technology, for our energy needs, for our domestic needs. If they embargo that, we have no way to refine those minerals in the United States to use them for our domestic capabilities. So I would propose to the administration, just like we have an oil reserve, a strategic oil reserve, in case something happens on the global stage, why not, Josh, have a strategic rare earths mineral reserves where we try to refine about 15 to 20% of rare earth minerals in the United States. You bring back some level of domestic manufacturing, but at a higher level, you can incorporate technology. I would say, look at what we did with the National Highway System under Eisenhower. Work with Congress, since we control it. Say, look, Congress, this isn't going to probably conclude by the end of my term, but I'm asking you all to appropriate about $250 billion. I want an 8-year project similarly to the National Highway System where the United States of America follows similarly again to what we have with the oil reserves, rare earth minerals reserve. Let's open up some of those manufacturing plants again. Let's modernize them. Let's have a private sector partnership. Big companies, small companies, let's bring in the little guy, give them opportunities here. Let's strengthen our relationships with Canada. They have a significant amount of rare earth minerals. And let's also strengthen our relationships with countries in Africa, South Africa. The Congo has about 90% of all precious metals in the country. Build relationships there. We're going to do a lot of it ourselves so that if we ever find ourselves, Josh, in a war, a conflict with China, whether it's in the South Chinese Sea or over Taiwan or whatever the case may be, if they decide to say, you know what, we're going to crush them where it hurts by shutting down, embargoing all rare earth minerals, outsourcing to them, it's cool. That's okay. We can produce it in the United States of America. And in a time of war, we will do what we did during World War I and World War II. All focus will be on refining those rare earth minerals. That's what I would do if I were advising President Trump. And that would be something that I would submit him as one of the greatest presidents in the history of this country.
I would agree with that. What I'm hearing from you is mostly what I hear from Scott Bessent, who I think is the actual logical person in the administration. But the problem with the tariffs in my mind is I'm hearing your side, which I totally agree with. It sounds super reasonable. It just makes sense. And then I'm hearing the Peter Navarro, Howard Lutnick side, where they're talking about unilateral, and they use the word reciprocal tariffs. They're not reciprocal. Like, we're putting 90% tariffs on people who have 8% tariff. So is this a new, in your opinion, is this a new tariff regime that we're looking at if it happens, if Congress were to pass this, or is it more strategic like you're saying?
I think it needs to be more strategic. I've even said this on air. I agree with the president's critique of why we need tariffs. Every economist, even Democrats have even acknowledged this, even those who are currently against the president on this have said, look, we actually do need to have better trade relations with our partners, because in a lot of ways we allow more than what they allow from us in terms of the exchange of goods and the tax that's on those goods in coming to their countries. We're pretty much saying, hey, bring it in. And they're saying, yeah, bring it in, but we're going to have a higher tax on those goods coming in. Democrats have even acknowledged, even Elizabeth Warren a couple of weeks ago, I believe, on either CNBC or MSNBC said, look, if you want to have a conversation about having better trade relations and having a fair tariff numbers, like maybe almost like how we have a flat tax, that argument, some have argued for a flat tax. Well, why not have like a flat tariff number, Josh, where we're going to say, look, to all of our allies, let's find a good number that's reciprocal for all of us. So if it's 8%, we think that's kind of high on maybe agriculture. And yet we're letting you guys import, we're importing whatever from you guys at a 4% rate, a 3% rate. How about we say 5%? Whatever the good is, let's have a flat 5% on all goods. Our friends in the EU, our British friends, our friends in India, our friends in Japan. I think that's reasonable. And if you want to go lower, I actually would like for it to be lower. Hell, if I have my way, Josh, I say let's do 2%, a flat 2% reciprocal tariff across the board on all goods. And this idea of going country by country, I wouldn't do it that way. I would go to all of our allies and say, this is what we want, 2%. Everybody who's willing to agree, come to the board. Let's get this done and move on. I promise you the markets would react positively. Big multilateral corporations will react positively. And I also think it would be an absolute benefit to our small business owners, who really are sort of the backbone of our economy. And I think a lot of our allies would benefit from it. And then once you do that reciprocal 2%, then you focus the ire on the Chinese. Because what we're seeing now is that India is really building up more of a robust manufacturing as they enter the next stage of their economic development. Which I think we can start shifting a lot more to India. You're seeing that with Apple, by the way. Apple is saying, look, we see what's going on with tariffs. There's a lot of uncertainty with China. We're going to start looking at India as a place to start building iPhones. Other companies, I believe, could do the same thing. Focus on the Chinese and try to weaken them as much as we possibly can, I think really needs to be the focus of the United States for a lot of reasons, militarily and also economically. They're obviously trying to usurp the dollar's global lead as the currency reserve of the world. And so that would be my focus if I were Congress, working with the executive on a more strategic and surgical approach that benefits the American consumer, benefits American corporations, but that's also beneficial in a reciprocal way to our allies, where they say, okay, we can agree with the United States on this, a flat number that's agreeable across the board on all goods. That's fair. Now, Mr. President, let's all focus the ire on the Chinese, because no one is benefiting from what China's doing, by the way. And I think China is in a really bad shape right now, Josh. 2023, Chinese economy was booming. You go to 2024, the Chinese economy started to slow down in a lot of ways, in part because their debt-fueled growth strategy is really catching up with them. You can't grow an economy as quickly as they have attempted to do with debt alone. Then the Chinese Import-Export Bank has given out these essential zero-based loans to developing nations to essentially curry favor with them, similarly to what we did after World War II, although I think our approach was a lot more surgical and more pronounced in terms of what the net result was. But they're attempting to try to follow that rubric. This is the opportunity now, Josh, to really pounce on China because of the stifling of economic growth there. They've increased military spending significantly. There are a lot of vulnerabilities there that I'm seeing, that I'm saying, let's figure this out with tariffs with our allies and really focus on crushing the Chinese before we give them an opportunity to reset.
Yeah. Speaking of countries that are in oodles of debt, the Big Beautiful Bill is a huge controversy right now. I'll tell you my take on it. So, and maybe, yeah, it's very controversial, but I think the Republican Party is split right now in this way. I think if you look at 2016, you see the Republican Party split between MAGA and neocons, essentially, right? George Bush, Republicans. I don't think that that's the split anymore. I don't. And the reason why I say that is because what I'm seeing the discourse online right now is the people who support the Big Beautiful Bill are saying to the people who don't, you're the rhinos. You're the not America first. And you're seeing the exact same from the people who don't support the bill towards the people who support the bill. And both are claiming to be MAGA. And so in my opinion, I think the Republican Party is pretty much MAGA through and through. I don't really think there's a meaningful base outside of that. However, what I'm seeing on the economic side is on one hand, you have the free market conservatives. And on the other hand, you kind of have the populist protectionists, I guess. And so my question to you, it seems that it barely passed the House, the Big Beautiful Bill.
Yep.
It seems it has no chance in the Senate in its current form.
It won't look the same.
No, it won't look the same at all. And so my question to you is, how does this bill look in order to get passed?
Before I answer that, how does it look before it gets passed? Well, actually, I'll answer that first. I don't know. I really, really don't know. There are some senators, Ron Johnson in particular. I think there are going to be a couple others who are going to say we need more cuts. This is just not enough. You can't. I run a business. Anyone out there, I'm sure you have a lot of followers who run businesses. You can't cut taxes while not offsetting spending. Like, you can't keep spending at the same level while also cutting taxes. If you're going to cut taxes, you have to decrease spending. I mean, that's just economics 101. Anybody who runs a business out there, they know exactly what I'm talking about. I have actually stated on air that I don't support this bill. I actually believe that the United States needs to focus on austerity. We need to limit and reduce spending in some significant ways outside of military spending. And I say that because of the growth of the Chinese budget as it pertains to developing their military. They're ahead of us with hypersonics. There are a couple of other technological revolutions that we have seen in the past year or two that have come from the Chinese military that we are a little behind. We need to catch up on. So I don't think it's now's the time to decrease military spending. With that said, though, we got to cut across the board. In about the next 5 to 10 years, give or take, I might be off here a couple years or so, the federal debt will be the largest line item on the federal budget. In about 25 to 30 years, our debt will be twice as big as what we're producing a year, meaning we're not, our GDP, we're not producing enough. We won't be producing enough in about 25 to 30 years to really tackle the ballooning debt. At some point, we're going to be looking at $100 trillion in debt. I don't know how that's sustainable. Now, one could argue, well, the United States could just default, and then because, you know, we are the world reserves. So look, we're just not going to pay this. Everybody depends on the United States, and we're going to just refresh. And if we do that, then we're going to find ourselves the way Italy and Venezuela found themselves. So that's not a viable alternative. The only alternative is to pay down the debt and see a surplus. The only way you can see that surplus, pay it down, cut expenditures. If I were to cut taxes, it would only be for middle and working class people. Like, I make a lot of money. I love to have my damn taxes cut. But for the sake of the country, the focus needs to be on the group that really does fill the void of that consumer base that I was talking about a couple moments ago. That 16 plus trillion, that is middle and working class families. So let's figure out a way to increase their wealth. Let's figure out a way to increase their spending capabilities. You can only do that by decreasing taxes on them, giving them an opportunity to also pay down their personal family household debt. And then we as a federal government focus on paying the national debt down as much as possible. Start with the interest, get that out of the way. I would say we probably could do that in about 4 or 5 years. Once the interest is down, then we can start going after the debt itself. And so I would argue maybe in about 8 years, Josh, we could see ourselves in a fiscally sound place where there's some level of a surplus, and then we go from there. The problem is, Josh, nobody wants to cut anything. No one in Congress wants to touch Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, any other program that, I hate to say this, that their constituents like and love and in a lot of ways depend on. This is a complicated thing, man. And somebody has to be the adult in the room and say, look, we can't afford to keep living this way. It's not good for the next generation. It's not good for the health of the country for the next century. We are going to have to make cuts. It is going to be tough for a lot of people right now. It is what it is. Now, we're going to try our best to not raise taxes on working class and middle class people. And where we can, I think we'll try to find ways to actually cut taxes. But we are going to cut spending across the board. All programs that are not necessity for the safety of the country, we're going to pause. Any program that isn't mandatory to preserve some level, baseline level of our safety net for people who live right above or below the poverty line, because we really want to take care of those people. I think we are a benevolent society in that regard. We're going to try our best not to touch those numbers, but you're going to see a decrease. And we will be more stringent on who can apply for those types of safety net programs. But no one's willing to say that, Josh, because they'll lose elections. But somebody has to say, man, this is not sustainable. And I don't understand what Congress, Republicans, Democrats, and even a lot of the American people out there who are saying, look, this is great. This is not great. It is not great having $100 trillion in debt. What happens, Josh, when Treasury attempts to sell U.S. Treasury bonds and investors, domestic and foreign, say, we don't want to buy them? because we have no confidence in the country's ability to pay it back.
It's basically what's happening right now.
Josh, last year, I believe in either January or February, was one of the first times ever, and you can Google this. I'm certain it was either last year or the year before. It was one of the first times, I think, in either a long time or ever, that the Treasury had a hard time selling notes.
Yeah.
It's never happened. And right. It's starting to happen because people are saying, we don't trust in your ability to pay this back. We don't trust if we get these bonds that the security and faith of the United States of America will assure in 30 years I can come back and cash these damn things in for a net positive net gain. People don't believe it anymore, man.
Yeah, the problem I see with this issue, when it comes to policy, obviously that's the politicians' jobs and Congress needs to get their act together. But with this one specifically, I just don't see the American people getting on board with it. And so I kind of made this dichotomy in my episode, I think, earlier this week, whereas there's kind of two thoughts to governing. On one hand, you've got the Ron Johnson thought, which is, and the Thomas Massey one, which is, I am committed to truth. The math doesn't math. It doesn't work. And then you have all the other people. And by the way, there's merit to both. I'm not trying to put shade on either. But the other side is, look, I know it's true. I also know what my constituents want. And I was elected to represent them. So I'm going to do what they want me to do, whether I think it's right or not. And so my concern with this one is, how do we get Americans on board? Does it require just an incredibly persuasive person to really break this down in a meaningful way? Or does it just require enough pain to be felt in the economy before people kind of have that aha moment?
I think you can, if I were advising President Trump, I would probably say, Mr. President, this isn't the bill. I would say, Mr. President, we have to cut. I would explain to the president, if we don't try to do this now, I would explain to him what is to come over the next 10 years and then the next 25 years. I would say, sir, you have an opportunity to stop this now. We cannot continue to wait. We can't wait until 2028, Josh, for the hope of a Republican to win, because at that point, again, the interest rates on the debt alone will be the largest line item on the federal budget, which meaning people don't understand what the hell I'm saying here. I'm essentially saying every line item that requires a payment from the federal government, most of it, the bulk of it, will have to go to servicing the interest on our debt. And then everything else, ladies and gentlemen, will follow after that. You have a household, I presume. You pay your own bills. It makes no sense for your debt to be the number one thing and then everything else follows. That means you have no savings. That means you have no rainy day reserves if something were to happen to you. If most people are aware of that in their everyday lives and are trying to have that balance, I would assume most people would say the federal government should do better. So if I were advising the president, I would say, sir, this is a problem. I would try to explain it to him why. And then I would say, we need to go start going across the country and talking to the American people about why this is so important to have cuts. And I think you'd win some people over. I don't think it would be enough, though. Unfortunately, I think sometimes people, and God, this sucks that it has to be this way, Josh, but sometimes people only learn when there is real crushing pain. But the problem is, Josh, when we get to that point, my friend, this is going to be even harder. Hell, it may even be almost impossible to tackle. Because the debt now is already around 100,000, 150,000 per American worker, I believe, somewhere in that ballpark. When we get to the place where it's $100 trillion, I mean, Josh, you're talking about $300,000-$400,000 per working American. The average American doesn't even make that. So think about mathematically what's going to be required to try to get that under control. This is a serious moment, precarious moment that we're in, and we may not feel it today. You just had a beautiful daughter. Congratulations. I just had a daughter. She's 4 months now. There are a lot of people out there with children and grandchildren. Again, we're okay now. But Josh, when you and I'm 34. I don't know how old you are, but in about 10, 15 years, okay, so 10, 15 years for both of us, we're going to really feel this. And for our children, it's going to be worse. And for our grandchildren, Josh, it will be unsustainable. Now, my hope, and there's some technologists that have said this, that maybe AI can help reset this in some very interesting ways in terms of the economics. I'm open to that argument. I'd love to see what that could look like and how feasible that would be. But we're not there yet, so I got to deal with reality. And reality says that we got a problem. Houston, we have a problem.
As many of you guys know, I have a brand new baby at home, and so I'm getting zero sleep right now. But fortunately, the partner of this show, Energy Rocks, gets me all the energy that I need for the gym. Energy Rocks replaces that heavy, sugary pre-workout drink with a light supplement that you can fit right in your pocket and eat anytime you need that boost. It's modeled after Pop Rocks. Energy Rocks was created by an athlete for competitive athletes and anyone who needs a caffeine boost without those messy mixes and the caffeine crashes. Guys, it's only 20 calories, 4 grams of sugar, and you get all of the energy that you would get from one cup of coffee. Go check them out right now, because just for my viewers, they're giving a 20% off their whole store. Just use the code JOSHCAR20 off at checkout. The link and that code are in the description below.
Shifting gears, one of the things I think that conservatives have made the biggest waves on recently is independent media. I think, like, if you think about it, not 10 years ago, conservatives were seriously struggling when it came to media. And I think if you look at it today, we dominate in the independent media in that sphere. I know that you've had a hand in that. I know you recently started something with your independent streaming platform. So I wanted you to talk just a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, Josh, I think it's a beautiful thing. When I first got involved in, I got involved with Republican politics when I was 14 years old. I started something called TARS, Teenage Republican Society. Most people don't even know it's a thing. It is a legitimate thing. I started that when I was in middle school, going up to high school. After high school, I went to a historically black college. I started the first college Republican chapter there in an era when we got the first black president. So let me tell you, it was not easy. But to my surprise, a lot of people respected it, because I guess they respected, like, man, you got to be pretty damn bold as a black person to be starting a Republican chapter at a black college. But I did it. And the chapter was highly successful even after I graduated and left. With that said, though, at the time, there was a lot of conversations in the country about how Republicans didn't control culture. Like, Democrats, they dominated the cultural conversation. And I even remember Speaker Gingrich. I worked on his presidential campaign my senior year in college, and he would always argue about the urgency for Republicans to start dominating the cultural conversation, because there are some customs of behaviors and norms that we as conservatives believe in advocating for, that we believe are structurally and foundationally important to a viable society. And we need to be able to have those conversations in an open way to be persuasive to people who may be willing to listen, including diverse people. And now here we finally are. The media is democratized. I think that's a beautiful thing. No longer do we have to deal with the bygone era of 4 or 5 big entities controlling everything, dominating the narrative. And oftentimes, as we now see many of them lean to the left, they say that their objective, they use journalism as a way to say, because I'm a journalist, therefore I'm objective. We all know that's not the truth. And if you were to ask most of them, where do you lean politically and how do you vote? About 99% of them lean to the left and vote for Democrats. And so now the American people have an opportunity to go to people like yourself, such as myself, Megyn Kelly, who's a friend, Ben Shapiro, who's a friend, David Rubin, who's a friend, Hugh Hewitt, and there are so many others, where people can now go and say, well, you know what? I want to listen to some disparate voices on politics, on economics, and I want to hear what they have to say. And then I want to formulate an opinion for myself on what I believe is ultimately the truth. And that's what brought me and my business partner, John, to our network, We The Free. I hope people will check it out, wethefree.com, WTF.TV, a play on words there. And we decided to start a network. Being a gun guy, I'm a big supporter of the Second Amendment, grew up in the South. I started shooting at 6 years old, hunting with my grandfather, and just fell in love with the sport of shooting, the sport of being a competitive shooter. I did that for a while, and just fell in love with guns in general. It's a great tool for a young boy if you're trying to teach a young boy discipline and to be studious and responsibility, because you learn pretty quickly the damage that a gun can cause if one is reckless and irresponsible. And that's the way my grandfather used that mechanism and that bonding time for me, my brother, and my cousins. With that said, being a big gun person, my business partner and I already had something in the gun space where we were creating content, as we've seen this new boom of black people and Latino people and Asian people and women really getting into guns. And so we said, hey, we should start something. And we did, and it did really well. And then we realized, like, hey, maybe we should start a network that services firearms in terms of firearms education, firearms entertainment content, action-oriented content, which falls under the same umbrella. gun-related news, which we have on the network, but also conservative or right-leaning and center-right-leaning podcasts and shows about culture and politics. And so we have all of that under the one umbrella, because what I realized, Josh, from a business perspective, was that there isn't a single place for people in the 2A community to go to consume all of this type of content that they like, whether it's guns or politics or entertainment. And the 2A space is a space of very, very loyal, energetic, patriot-loving, American-loving people. And so we realize that there's an opportunity for us to grow something in this space and offer something not only to our space, but also as we begin to market this thing, which we just started about a week ago, to start reaching out to people on the right to say, hey, if you like conservative politics, check out some of our podcasts, because most conservatives are also gun adjacent. They're big supporters of the Second Amendment. So maybe we can bring some of them to being more stronger and vibrant and fervent supporters of the Second Amendment. And so that's what we've built. We think it's something that's unique, and I'm praying to God that it's successful. And I hope people will go and join us and join us on this journey. I mean, look, nothing is built overnight. It took Daily Wire 10 years to get to where they are. And we just launched this thing, Josh, April 15th, April 17th. So barely a month ago. And if you go and check out the website, download the app, you'd be surprised by how much we were able to do in such a short amount of time, starting with producing things in February. So again, this goes to show you that there's opportunity in the space. YouTube, for example, where you host your show, is the largest visual medium in the world. And if you look at what entities like Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, Apple Plus, what all of the presidents that are running these organizations are saying is that there's not enough content. We need more content because people are consuming so much on these little devices. And so we're hoping to bring something to the Second Amendment space, but to also bring something to patriot-loving Americans who say, hey, I'm willing to spend $9 a month to support what these guys are doing and to get great content and to be a part of this journey versus spending my money on entities that don't respect me, that don't like my views, even on YouTube. And I love YouTube, man. But as a gun person, they're constantly demonetizing us. They're constantly shadow banning us. They're constantly kicking us off. Now, right now, they've laid back a little bit, Josh, but that's only because President Trump won the election. We know that pendulum is going to swing back to the other side if we don't win in 2028. And so our argument to the marketplace is, why keep being treated that way? Why put our eyeballs on a platform or put our dollars behind people who don't like us, who don't respect us, who only value our dollars, versus putting those dollars and those eyeballs behind people who do view things the way we view things, who are going to be champions of our ideals, which I believe are American ideals.
Yeah, when I went and checked it out, I was really impressed. Not just, there's a lot of stuff on there. I was very surprised when you said it was just started in April. There's a lot on there, but also the quality, super high. For any of you guys who are interested in watching right now, I'm going to put a link to it in the description below so you can go check that
out. Thank you, man.
Yeah, no worries. I wanted to talk a little bit about DEI and racial politics with you. Sure, the DEI stuff specifically, I think, has obviously massively backfired for Democrats over this last year specifically, and Trump has done a fantastic job with that. Mm-hmm. One of their biggest mistakes, in my opinion, is lumping different minorities into one category because they're not all the same, you know? Whether it's racial minorities, no race is the same. I mean, really no person is the same. And the fact that they'll, you know, link gay people and trans people together, or black folk and Hispanics, is ridiculous. You obviously articulated this really well in the video that I showed that ended up kind of connecting us, and a lot of people were watching it and agreeing with you. I want to show that video again for everyone to see.
Sure.
And then I want to get your reaction to it and kind of your take of hearing it in real time.
And that's exactly the same kind of argument that they made against integrating the military when Harry Truman did it. I'm sorry, it's the same argument. Okay. It's the same
argument. I mean, is she wrong about that, though? Okay. She is right about that.
Did not want to serve
I'm aware.
White people didn't want to serve the black people because of unicohesion. So now you're saying gay people shouldn't serve with straight people.
We only have a couple seconds. Chair Michael, I see that you're frustrated that she made that argument, but is she wrong that unit cohesion was used as an excuse to keep the military segregated for a long time?
I think we should
and also on, don't ask, don't tell
we
when
should,
it comes
we,
to
we should focus on the
discriminating
issue.
Against gay same and lesbian people.
We should focus on the issue at hand. That's what I think.
Same argument.
But
No,
we should focus on the issue at hand. I don't know why we keep going to bringing up race. Let's just focus on the issue at hand.
Look, it's race, sexual orientation. We've seen this twice, right? In two major junctures for the military. I'm just wondering, if she is drawing parallels here between the arguments that are being made to maintain this policy.
I reject those parallels. That's my answer. I reject the parallels. I think they're ludicrous parallels.
Obviously, I'm not a Black American, but I want to hear from you. How does that feel?
You don't say.
I am as British as it comes. But I want to hear from you when you hear those arguments. How does that feel?
Something I'm reminded of, a good friend of mine, Ryan Gerdusky. I don't know if you're familiar with Ryan Gerdusky. He's a good friend. He's been a friend years. And he's close friends with Ann Coulter, the conservative writer and author. And Ann Coulter, a couple years ago, said that she was talking about affirmative action. And she was saying that she said affirmative action was intended for Blacks and nobody else. And she was saying at the time, she said, if Democrats keep advocating for all these other groups, she said, what's going to end up happening is that affirmative action is going to come to an end. And I'm sort of surmising what she said, but her point was that she said, I think she was talking about white people, we're going to get tired of this. Because now you're bringing in everybody, and that's not the intent. And I think she was a little ahead of her time when she was making that argument, and she was pretty much saying like, we don't owe anybody else anything. There's only one group that we should be, you know, trying to figure some things out, and that's Black people, not everybody else. And I thought she was right. And I remember reposting that video again. Man, this was a couple of years ago now, so maybe it was like 4 or 5 years ago. But I reposted the video because I thought her argument was just such a cogent point, and she was right. I mean. Look, dude, affirmative action, the initial goal of affirmative action was to have a reset of some of the ills that were done against Blacks and to try to have equilibrium, particularly in terms of academic attainment and economic attainment. And the reality at the time was, and this is still prescient today, was just that, look, there is a huge divide between the white racial or the white economic gap and also white academic attainment gap. And we got to figure out what we can do to fix that. It wasn't. The intent was not to say, well, because you're Black, you should just be let into a school, irregardless of your performance. The intent wasn't you should be hired for a job because you're Black. The intent was, let's make sure we're giving the same opportunities to Black people for certain schools, the same opportunities to Black people in certain job sectors. And I actually think that's a good thing. And I would venture to say that most white people would probably say, yeah, I don't have a problem with just making sure that people have equity. Like, let's just make sure that everybody has the same opportunities. We can't guarantee an outcome, but what we can say is, look, everybody should have the same opportunities and you rise or fall based on your merit and your ability to rise to the occasion. That to me makes all the sense in the world. The unfortunate reality to me, though, is that Democrats and this, I don't understand why more Black people haven't fought them on this. They opened Pandora's box by saying affirmative action, Latino people, LGBT people, like any civil rights era legislation that was passed explicitly for the atonement of some of the issues we've had in the past to try to catch people up. We've now opened that door for any and everybody. And so now you've effectively diluted the original intent of what those laws were passed, what those legislations was ultimately passed into law to rectify, which was previous issues, which was to close economic gaps, which was to give opportunity to people in the job space by letting everybody essentially claim that what occurred to Blacks during slavery and during civil rights, Jim Crow era, which isn't that long ago, you're only talking 5 decades ago. Now you're allowing everybody else to make an argument, an argument that they claim is a justifiable one based upon that history. And for me, Josh, I don't know how you connect those dots. Like, it's so insulting to me when I see that. It's not the same. It is never the same. Even the birthright citizenship part, President Trump wanted to end that. And his argument was, and the White House's attorney at SCOTUS even said, the 14th Amendment was passed to give citizenships to freed slaves. That was it. Not everybody else. It was literally to correct the notion that, what was it? I think Dred Scott, where it's like, you know, Blacks are 3/5 an individual. They have no rights. So it's like, okay, yeah, we'll give you a little bit of rights, but you would never be recognized as citizens. And so the 14th Amendment was an attempt to correct that. And it was a damn good attempt to correct that. I think we'd all agree. So how then do you fast forward 150 years later and say, if you're a Latino person, you come into the country, you have a child, the child is now an American citizen, anchor babies. Or if you're from a country in Africa, or hell, even if you're from Sweden, I don't particularly care what the ethnicity is, and I want to be clear about that. Those individuals, irregardless of the race, should not, or regardless of race, I should say, excuse me, regardless of race, should not be able to make a claim for citizenship based on the 14th Amendment, when the 14th Amendment was solely passed to correct one particular thing pertaining to slavery. And so to answer your question about, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion and affirmative action in general, I think by muddying the water, I think a lot of people, even people that I know who will say, like, yeah, I think we should have equity, like we should give opportunities to everybody, are now saying, but you know, Shermichael, this isn't really the same when everybody's making the same argument to this claim, when they don't have any right to this claim. So we're just going to end it. We're just going to end it. And so for Democrats, I think they honestly, man, caused some harm in some ways to some black people who might still require some additional help to try to climb the ladder a little bit. And I think that blame is on them. Like, example, we just talked about this on Abby's show on CNN. San Francisco is now trying to get rid of grading students because they're saying it's about equity. And I said on the show, well, this is what George W. Bush said. This is the bigotry of low expectations. And this goes to my point. Equity is about making sure we have an opportunity, regardless of what you look like, where you come from, what you believe. I'm okay with that, Josh. I'm okay with saying Josh should have the same opportunity as my friend who's black or Latino. Now, if Josh is better than my friend who is black and Latino, then Josh is going to do better, and he should do better. If my friend who's Latino is better than Josh and my black friend, then that person should do better. And if my black friend is better, you get the point that I'm trying to make. But what we're not going to do is say that we're going to guarantee that everybody should have the same success, because you can't, Josh. Our intellectual faculties are different. Our creativity is different. Our willingness to persevere certain things is just different. And by virtue of all of those uniquenesses in every individual, you can't guarantee that we're all going to get to the same finish point. Now, we can say, look, if you got what it takes, we'll make sure you all have an opportunity to try. But we're not going to start this game here of saying you're going to get the same outcome by virtue of what you look like, or because of your gender, or because of your sexual orientation. I don't think you can ever do that. I think it lowers standards. And so when I see these cases such as that, I say you actually are causing more harm to not just black kids, because it's not just black kids who are struggling academically. It's poor white kids who are struggling academically. It's poor Latinos who are Americans or American citizens who are struggling academically. And when you lower these standards, that's not equity, Josh. That really is trying to just, you know, give everyone the same outcome by saying, well, you're struggling, so we're just going to change it so you can appear as good as the kids who are working hard. That's not helping those kids, man. You are erasing every opportunity that those kids could potentially have to do well and thrive in life by lowering the standards. Because once they get out of the comforts of high school, and if they can make it to college, or if they get into the workplace, no one's going to care about your inefficiencies. They're going to say, can you do the job or you can't? I'm going to give you an opportunity, right? This is the equity part, by hiring you. But if you can't meet and rise to the occasion, you will be fired. And so to me, man, I think we've gone down a very dangerous and treacherous route here with this. I think it's unfortunate that we have allowed other people to piggyback off of the history of slavery and all these other things to say, well, because they are a person of color, then they too should be able to qualify for this. And people have said in the country, well, you know what? We've had enough of this, so nobody will get the benefit from anything. That's just the way the cookie crumbles. And now it's that we all will have to rise to the occasion, as we should, based on our merit and based on our abilities. And now every other group will no longer be able to say, well, because of slavery, I too should be given the same thing that was given to blacks. Nope, that's bye-bye. Those days are long gone and over. And I got to say just quickly, I'm disappointed in the Supreme Court on this, because I thought the Trump administration's attorney during that oral arguments with the New Jersey Attorney General made a strong point about this is what the 14th Amendment was all about. Why? And the fact that Democrats would even try to make it, like, it's so insulting, Josh, to the history of slavery, that Democrats, where most black people happen to vote Democrats, wouldn't recognize the delineation between the difference. And my hope is that more black people would say, like, okay, this is just not okay, because it is not the same. It's not the same to be able to point to these things if you're a part of LGBT or, again, you're some immigrant from some other country. It is not the same to point to this and say, because of these things, then I have the same rights as birthright citizenship, or because of these things, I should have the same rights to X, Y, and Z. I don't agree with it. I don't like it. And I think it puts Democrats in a really pathetic place. It shows me what they really think about black people. And I think it's why you're starting to see, at a minimum, a lot of black men who are saying, you know, I don't like this. This doesn't pass the smell test for me. I'm going to go ahead and give the Republicans an opportunity with my vote.
Yeah, I think that is what we're seeing. If you look in the past five elections, you know, I would say black Americans are slowly going towards
especially
the Republican
men.
Party. But yeah,
especially
but
men.
Especially men. One of my theories.
Josh, let me ask you this though. Before you, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, you're obviously, like you said, you're not a black person. I get it. But what are your thoughts on, like, yeah, hey, we are going to give people an opportunity. Like we're all for equity, but we're not going to promise outcomes. Like what are your thoughts on how you view that from your perspective?
Yeah, well, there's two sides to it, right? On one hand, I grew up in a very affluent area in Utah. People are very entrepreneurial, and so I see people who just do the thing. They just do it, you know?
Just do it, yeah.
On the other hand, I do have to also recognize that I grew up in an affluent area. There's not a lot of black Americans specifically here where
sure,
I live.
Sure.
And so there is room, like you were saying, for, well, you know, Jim Crow was only 60 years ago.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Slavery was only, you know, a little more than, you know, a century and a half ago.
Yeah.
And so it's a tricky one. I think at the end of the day, what I've seen is for the few minorities that are in my area, they are fantastically successful. And what really drives that is just taking accountability of your life and proving your merit. And I'm of the opinion, again, you can say, you know, I just grew up in Utah, I had it super easy. But what I see is that when people just make it happen, America has provided at this point in history every opportunity for them to do so.
When you're given, and again, I like the keyword opportunity, and that goes to the equity part of like, hey, when someone says, I'm going to give you an opportunity regardless of what you look like, if someone wants to thrive, they will rise to the occasion. And it's not about, and I just want to be clear on this, Josh, because I know this is such a complicated topic to talk about. I can't guarantee what someone's outcome can be by giving them an opportunity. Like, I just can't. I can't force them to work hard. I can't force them to be studious. I can't force them not to give up when the future looks bleak. But at a minimum, I can say, look, I'm going to give you the shot at this. And the rest, it falls on you. And I think, you know, people are willing to take that opportunity. And that's sort of where I'm at. I'm all for sharing my opportunities with other people, because I want to see people do as well. I'm all for opening my Rolodex to say, hey, I'll give you a shot. But I always make clear, like, hey, I don't know how this is going to work out for you, but if I can help you and you're open to my help and I can bring in others to help you, then you'll probably do pretty damn well if you work hard enough. And look, we have absolutely progressed. There's no doubt about it. We've had a lot of successful African-Americans, and I would like to see more. And there are some things that I think even we as a community, we have to strengthen a little bit. There's no perfect community. I think there's some cultural things that we have to say, okay, we got to tone this down. This is probably not in the best interest of our culture if we want the type of success that we're seeing among other groups. And I think that's an internal thing. The government can't do anything about that. No quote-unquote allyship can do anything about that. That's an internal thing that we have to reconcile with on our own. And so, again, if you want to talk about equity, the way I see it as opportunity, giving people an opportunity. But I absolutely reject this notion that we can guarantee outcomes. I've never known that to be possible in my own experience. I've never known that to be possible. And if I'm wrong, then hey, someone in the comment section, please correct me. And I'm open to reading how and where I'm wrong on this. I just don't see how I am.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think another kind of experience that I've had that has really shaped that for me is, we were talking before we recorded, but I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I served a mission. I was Spanish speaking. You know, I have thousands and thousands of Mexican friends because of this mission that I was serving for 2 years. And, you know, all minorities, technically. And these were people who in many, many cases, you know, had come here illegally or had come here legally. And in any case, they were new here. They didn't know the language. They were having a very hard time. Yet through all of that, they didn't expect the U.S. government to take care of them 100%. They just said, we're going to figure this out. And I actually met some incredibly successful people who you would just imagine everything was fighting against them. I think when you see experiences like that, when you have those, it really cements in you this idea of America is the best place in the world. And even if there are hard things that happen, and even if there might be some injustices throughout history, at the end of the day, it's as you say, you cannot guarantee an outcome for someone. You can only give them the opportunity.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes the United States so great, is that we do give people opportunities. And for me as a Black person, I mean, like, I grew up in the South. My grandparents were like the second class to desegregate a school in Louisiana. And so I know from firsthand what that experience has been like. But I also know, like, when we talk about merit and people working hard, to me as a Black person, I've always been surprised that Republicans have never figured this out, because the way we talk about this, I'm going to be honest, it does turn off a lot of Black people, Josh, and I don't think we have to go about it this way. I think we can say, look at what Black people had to go through 50, 60 years ago, and you have Black lawyers, you have Black doctors, you have Black teachers, you had Black people who were becoming business individuals, and they did all of those things despite insurmountable odds, Josh, things that I can't imagine today as a young Black man in 2025. Imagine how smart you had to be, the due diligence you had to do. No one gave you anything in those days, man, because most of the time they didn't even want you at the schools or on the job in the first place. And so the type of perseverance one had to have in terms of what their personal individual ethos was about what they were capable of, think about that. That exists among Black people. That's in you. We're simply saying we want to see that continued on today. And so I think there's a way for Republicans to message the Black American experience. While it is indeed trifled with a lot of pain, look at what came out of the pain. That is a beautiful part of the American story in and of itself, of how America came out of pain to earn its freedom, and the deaths that we had to from Britain to the Civil War to keep the Union together. Look at what we had to go through as a country to get to where we are. Black people have a unique history that's very similar to the history of the country in terms of what you had to overcome to get there. And so if I were the Republican Party and I were to communicate to Black people, I would simply say, when we talk about merit, we're simply trying to say that people should get to a place of where they are because they have worked hard, they've gained it, they've earned it, no one gave anything to them. And we're not saying that Black people aren't capable, but we know you're capable, and we know Black people are capable despite very challenging odds. We merely need to look just 5 decades ago. And so let that be the inspiration to continue to fuel academic excellence and entrepreneurial excellence among Black people today. That to me is a beautiful message, man. That's a beautiful message. And unfortunately, we're not, I don't know why, Josh, but we're not messaging it the way that I just messaged it. But I promise you, if we were to, I think a lot of Black people would say, well, you know, we did accomplish a lot of things before, despite a lot of difficult things. Look at how open and the opportunities we have today. If we did all of this, then imagine what we can do now. And if the Republican Party is going to say, look, we know that there's some economic differences. There's some Black people who don't have the same access to things. And as a party, we're going to, through public-private partnerships, through capitalism, we're going to try to levy opportunities for some Black people who are sort of in poverty, below that poverty line, so that you can ascertain your goals and be a part of that great academic and economic pursuits that make this country so vibrant. We're going to help you guys there. Let us be the party, Josh, of opportunity. And we're going to build upon that opportunity based upon the history of Black people in the past, because we know what's possible. Versus what the Democratic Party says, which is that because of what happened in the past, the only way you can achieve and succeed and thrive to your pursuits of success is if we hold your hand every step of the way. The Republican Party message should be, that's not what we're going to do, because we recognize Black people need autonomy. We recognize what you're capable of because of what you have accomplished in the past. We want to unlock that when we talk about merit, because we know that you want your children to reach success at every height, and we want to help you get there. That is an amazing message of individualism, of that old what is it? The pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Is that old dynamic that we used to talk about, you know, years ago in the Republican Party of yesteryear? We need to get back to that messaging, because that messaging, to me, I think, is in sync with where I think the party's trying to go, Josh. I just don't think we're really communicating it in the most effective way. But I think there's a way to communicate what we're trying to communicate better, and have it, believe it or not, a lot of Black people, especially a lot of Black men, who would say, I agree with this. I like this. If the Republican Party is going to try to help me figure it out, because I don't know, I didn't come from a wealthy family. If it's, you know, this particular Black person, or my family didn't go to college, I don't really know where to go, where to look. Yeah, there's things that I guess should make it a little easier, but I need a little guidance. And then if the Republican Party is saying, well, hey, you come on over here, we're going to help you, we're going to guide you, we're going to make sure that you have the opportunities to make yourself studious enough to succeed. That is the Republican Party. The Republican Party is a party of opportunity if you work hard enough to earn it. And that is the message that I think will be palatable, not just to Black people, man, but to every minority group in this country. We're not communicating it quite that way, but I think if we were to, I think we could potentially see continued electoral dividends like we saw in this last election last November.
I completely agree with you. It's one of the biggest things I've tried to push the from my small sphere of influence to try to push them to do. I think if you asked a Republican in the 90s, or if you know, would you believe that in 2024, the majority of Native Americans voted for a Republican, or that almost a majority of Hispanics voted for a Republican, I think they would be flabbergasted. I don't think they would believe it.
No one would believe you. And even if you were to go back to Obama's term, and if you would say that a Republican, Donald Trump of all people, would perform as well as any Republican since Richard Nixon with Black people, people say, oh, that's not going to happen. Black people don't vote Republican in those numbers anymore. They would laugh at you. And yet Donald Trump performed better than any Republican since Richard Nixon with Black men in particular. I mean, you look at states like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Texas, he saw double-digit increases. I mean, in some of these states, he got 8-9% the first time around. This time he got 18%, I think, in North Carolina. In Texas, he got over 20% of Black men. Over 20%, Josh. In North Carolina, I believe it was a little over 20% there as well, or right under 20%. Those are numbers to be built upon. And I think the Republican Party has the vision and the right message if communicated in a way that people can get it, where they'll say, you know what, the hell with Democrats. I'm going to put on my Make America Great Again, because I want to make America great. And I think you'll see those numbers increase. I really believe that.
I think that's fantastic. I completely agree. Before you go, I have a couple other questions about CNN specifically, because you're a CNN contributor. Mm-hmm. I think that's where a lot of people know you from. So I want to ask you, what is it like working with Scott Jennings and being across the table from him when he just goes in so brutally, but also eloquently with the leftists on Abby's show?
I mean, look, Scott's a dear friend, and we talk almost every other day. And sometimes when we're on together, you know, it's interesting because when we talk about race on the show, and if it's a Democrat and they're talking to me, I always feel, and that could be wrong in my feelings here, but I'm just going to be transparent. I feel as if sometimes people bring it up because I'm Black and a Republican and a conservative. And sometimes I feel like it's almost like a, well, don't forget who you are kind of thing. And that irritates me because it's like, I know I'm Black. I wake up Black every day. I don't need to be reminded of it. I'm not appalled or ashamed to be Black, which I sometimes see that ludicrous crap on social media because people disagree with me. And so it really irritates me when people bring that up. And sometimes when I really lose it on that topic, Scott will text me and he'll say, brother, calm down. We all know what they're doing. Don't allow them to get you to say something that you might not be able to take back. And that's the kind of guy that Scott is. You know, we're on together. We double team. Like we'll give each other certain looks when the camera's not on us. And he has a way to say, hey, you get this one, because this one will be a little easier for you to navigate. And there'll be my moments where I'll say, I don't know if I want to really touch this one the way I want to. So you go ahead and have at it. And I'll back you. Like we have our little signals and we double team. And now we're pretty much on together. Like we weren't on together this week because Scott has some business stuff going on. But next week, usually I'm on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and they told me, they said, hey, Scott, really, you know, want you guys on together. So we'll be on Monday and Tuesday together instead of just Tuesday and then me Wednesday with somebody else. And I think the network likes it. It's good for the network. It's good for their ratings. And look, it's good, I think, for Republicans to see Scott is a little older than me. I'm 34. I think Scott's in his maybe like middle to late 40s, maybe late 40s. And so there's a generational difference. But Scott represents a different form of conservatism for some Americans. And I think I'm sort of representing a newer, younger type of conservatism. And yet we're still sort of speaking the same language, Josh, but just in different ways. And I think people appreciate that. But it also showcases the diversity within our party. Like, people love to say, oh, Republicans are, they're so not diverse. Oh, they're just a bunch of white people. Well, Donald Trump kind of flipped that upside down. Again, over 40% of Latinos, men and women, voted for him. He increased his numbers from 12% of the black vote the last time to 13%. But when you break down the data, then you really start to see how well he performed again. I point out Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Texas, because those are some of the biggest numbers. And those are some states with large black populations. Trump, you know, New York Times had an analysis that came out, I believe, last week that showcased he performed exceptionally well in black counties across the country, where Kamala Harris didn't do as well. And, you know, she was a black woman running for presidency. So, again, when you start looking at the metrics, you are seeing, from my perspective, as someone who worked on a lot of campaigns, a lot of hope about the Republican Party building Americans of every color and creed who love this country, who loves what this country stands for, who want to preserve this country, who want to defend this country. And they may look a little different on the outside, but internally they all have the same beliefs. That's a belief in the Constitution. They love God, and they want to see this country continue to be great for generations to come. And dude, Donald Trump, of all damn people, and I hope I can say damn on your show, was able to do that. That surprises the heck out of me. It wasn't John McCain. It wasn't Mitt Romney. And those are good guys. Nothing against them. I know some people have their political differences, but none of them were able to do it. And Trump, in all of his uniqueness, I'm still baffled by it, Josh, when I think about it, because I'm a numbers guy. So I always like to go back and look at the numbers. I'm like, man, this guy, of all the others, was able to do something that no one else was able to do. And you have to do nothing but salute this guy and say, well done, Mr. President, because, yeah, you know, you speak sometimes in a brash tone, and sometimes he's unpredictable. Sometimes he says some colorful as hell crazy things, and that is a part of who he is. It's why people like him. And yet his message of, hey, we need to reach out to black people. Trump wanted to do that during his campaign when he was campaigning in the Bronx. No Republican had ever done that. And I remember when Pastor Daryl Scott, who's very close to Trump, reached out to me and said, hey, the president's thinking about this. I want you to put together, you know, maybe a short blueprint for us of how he could talk to black men, because he really wants to do it. I said, okay, give me a week. I spent the time putting together a strategy of, like, these are the focuses. These are the things that I think he should really talk about. And he gave it over to Susie Wiles. And weeks later, here was President Trump in the Bronx. Here was President Trump going here, going there. Here was Trump talking about, hey, we want economic opportunity for all Americans, specifically our men of color. And so men of color looked at that and they said, you know, I know what people say about Trump. I hear what the news media is saying about Trump, but I want to give Trump an opportunity. I want to give Republicans an opportunity, because I have voted so consistently one way for so long, and the dividend payouts haven't been great. If I was an investor, I would have sold those shares and put them somewhere else. And so now black men, they haven't sold all the shares, but they're saying, I'm gonna sell a little bit of the shares. I'm going to put a little bit of them on the right and see what that dividend payout will be for me over the next 2 or 3 or 4 years. And if it's great, then maybe I'll put a little bit more. And so that's why I was saying, and I think you'd agree with this, I think you're going to see a little more from black men and Latino men and Latino women moving over to the right. I think you're going to, if we can continue to deliver on the promise of economic opportunity and prosperity, I think you'll continue to see that transition.
Final question for you. Since you have that kind of up and close relationship and experience with CNN, I want to kind of present a theory that I have for you about the mainstream media and legacy media. There's a lot of people out there who say the legacy media is corrupt, and they talk about how, you know, they'll talk about how it's really scary how they'll all just say the same thing. It's like almost verbatim. They're saying the same exact things. Maybe it's coming from a certain person, like they're sending a script out to these people. My theory is very different. And I want to know what you think about this, since you know, are with these people very often. My theory is that the scariest part is that it's not a script, is that these people are in a way stuck in a bubble and they all think the very same. From your perspective, is that how it is? And kind of ending on a positive note, how can we help those people actually be exposed to different viewpoints?
I mean, you got to, you know, well, I don't know if you can help those people. Networks have to be purposeful in wanting to have diversity of thought on their airwaves. Now, CNN has its token conservatives, Scott, me, David Urban, and there's one other guy who I'm forgetting. They just brought him on a couple months ago, and it's just four of us. MSNBC, they have former Republicans who are not supportive of Trump, and I want to say it that way because some of these guys I have a lot of respect for, and I think sometimes some Republicans have allowed their dislike of Trump to soften or suspend their conservative critique of liberalism. And I wouldn't do that. I think you can be critical of Trump, but still say, my pronouncements are still going to be steeped in conservatism. But MSNBC doesn't really allow that. And so that's a corporate decision. I said on Abby's show Tuesday night when we were talking about journalism, I said, journalists are not objective. We were talking about the guy from CBS who gave the speech at Wake Forest. I don't know if you've covered that on your show. How he was, Peter something. I don't remember his name, but he was just saying like, First Amendment is under attack. You got to stand up journalism, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, Abby, I said, journalists are not objective. There's not a single person who would turn on any major network and say the mainstream media is filled with objective journalists. They would say these are journalists who have a particular point of view. And I said, at a minimum, be transparent with the American people and say, look, I am a Democrat. This is my perspective. But I'm going to try my best to present the news in an objective fashion. So at least the viewer has a way of knowing, okay, this person views things this way. And if a little bit of that comes out in their presentation, I can set it to the side because for the most part, they're trying to be objective. And that goes for the left and the right. But it's really a pronounced problem on the left. It's why mainstream media from a business perspective is structurally in trouble. It's why the ratings are in the can. It's why advertising dollars are in the can. And that's how a lot of them make their money. They thrive and have survived for so many years off of advertising dollars because those advertising dollars are uniquely linked to viewership. The more eyeballs you get, the more money advertisers are willing to spend. If eyeballs are down, the advertising money is going to go away. And you're seeing that. Advertising companies are starting to put their money behind digital individuals. Like those big companies who want to advertise, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, etc., AutoZone, whatever the case may be, they're saying, well, why would we continue to spend millions and millions out of our budget on cable news when we can put it behind some of these guys in the digital space? And so I think right now the digital space is still has some of these sort of quasi small entities that are advertising, folks who are trying to sell gold and silver and folks who are trying to sell vacation packages and stuff like that. I think, Josh, that is going to change structurally because the digital sphere ecosystem is becoming so big, the viewership reach is so big that advertisers are taking note and they're starting to shift those dollars to some of those digital creators to say, well, these guys have a greater reach than some of these shows on mainstream media. They're getting hundreds of thousands or millions of views a day versus a network that may get 400,000 and it may take a week for them to reach a million. That just doesn't make any sense from a business perspective. And so that's not going to go away. And it's not going to go away in part because many journalists have lost trust of the American people. People just don't trust them anymore. And I don't think they've done enough to recover. In fact, I think they've doubled down on their disposition. And I think they've doubled down for the simple fact that many of them do lean to the left and they do believe the things that they say. And look, I'm an American. I'm for diversity of thought. I think people should be able to believe what they want to believe. I just simply say be transparent about those beliefs if you're not going to bring on others to draw a contrast. And if you are going to bring others to draw a contrast, maybe have a conservative anchor a show. Why does every anchor have to be a liberal? I'm certain that they're liberals. Why not have one conservative anchor a show? The show would and I would imagine some networks don't want to do that because that conservative might outshine some of their biggest stars. And so unless they reconcile with this moment that they now find themselves in, ratings will continue to crash. Younger people are not watching mainstream media. They're watching TikTok. They're watching your show on YouTube and others. They're hopefully joining We the Free TV. They're looking for alternative sources. That's not going to change. And so if you're in the mainstream, you got to figure out a way to switch over from a less reliance on legacy or cable and start to rebuild your business model in the digital ecosystem. But you can't do it with the distrust being as high as it is. They have got to deal with this trust issue. That it's a real business problem for them. And I don't see an interest in really dealing with that. And so even if they were to pivot to digital, I think the numbers would still will pale in comparison to other creators who are viewed as more authentic and trustworthy.
Amazing. Shermichael Singleton, everyone. Shermichael, are there any final words that you want to leave with my viewers?
Yeah, I think this was fun. I would just simply say, you know, continue to support people who are advocating for your perspective. This is not easy. Trying to start a business in my case or trying to build and continue to build your YouTube channel, which is a business in and of itself, is not easy. And people, guys, put in a lot of sweat equity, a lot of hours, in our case, a lot of dollars also, to try to build something for people like us who for so long have had their voices stifled, shadow banned, kicked off of platforms merely because we viewed the world differently. And what we've come to find is that we're not alone. 50% of Americans share our beliefs. And there are even some on the left who share our beliefs economically. They may be fiscally conservative, or culturally, they may be conservative. On an immigration front, they may say, I agree with Republicans. Maybe I wouldn't go as far as them on how they're handling immigration, but I think their critique of the problem is spot on. We need to make room for those people, and we need to support people who are going to advocate for those ideals, such as yourself, such as myself. And so I will simply say, don't put your dollars and your time behind people who don't respect you. Don't. Let's continue to build upon people who value things the way we do, who share our values, who share our ethos about life, who have a strong faith in God and belief. And believe in treating people the right way. I think that's the conservative disposition. That's what I think Republicans try their best to represent. And so that would be my message. Let's continue to build with our own, and let's stop wasting our time with people who never really give us the time of day. They just want our dollars and our eyeballs. Let's end that.
Thank you so much, guys, for watching this conversation with myself and Shermichael. Please like the video and subscribe to my channel so other great patriots like yourself will see it. And you can tune in every single day at 6 p.m. for the live show, or you can watch another video right here.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.